Welcome back, everyone. This is Austin Roberts. Here at the Ecosiv Podcast, we engage leading thinkers in conversations about the kinds of transformations required to create a more sustainable, peaceful, and just world.
Hello, everyone. We welcome you to our second discussion highlighting Jainism and the ecological mindset in the context of the Dharma traditions. My name is Juliana Arnold, and I lead the Ecological Mindset Project here at the Institute for Ecological Civilization, where you can find us at ecosiv.org. A big thanks today to our sponsor, Dr. Jasvant Modi, and Christopher Miller from the Arihanta Academy. Our Ecological Mindset Project aims to launch a movement on ecology and the Dharma traditions across North America, with a focus on the Jain Dharma concept of ahimsa, or nonviolence. We recognize that to successfully address the growing ecological crisis, we need a shift in human consciousness. That is a shift towards an ecological mindset. We will meet with distinguished scholars in the Dharma traditions to discuss the interconnectedness between Dharma traditions and ecological processes, and to highlight how Jain Dharma represents a fundamentally ecological way of life. Today, we welcome our guest, Jeffrey Long, for a discussion on Jainism, ecology, and the environment. Jeffrey Long is a religious studies scholar who works on the religions and philosophies of India, particularly Hinduism and Jainism. He graduated with a BA from the University of Notre Dame in 1991, where his understanding and interest in Hinduism cemented, as later informed in his work. He received his MA and PhD at the University of Chicago Divinity School in 1993 and 2000. His PhD thesis is titled Plurality and Relativity, Whitehead Jainism and the Reconstruction of Religious Pluralism. Ever since 2000, Long has worked as a professor of religion and Asian studies at Elizabethtown College. He has written 5 books, plus another one as sole editor, on Hinduism and Jainism, titled A Vision for Hinduism Beyond Hindu Nationalism, Hinduism in America, A Convergence of Worlds, Jainism an Introduction, and Historical Dictionary of Hinduism. His latest publications include Discovering Indian Philosophy, An Introduction to Hindu, Jain, and Buddhist Thought, and his edited volume, Perspectives on Reincarnation, Hindu, Christian, and Scientific. His books and research has brought extensive knowledge of Hinduism and Jainism throughout the West and act as an important exposure to the Dharma traditions outside of India. Thank you so much for taking the time today to have this rich and deliberate discussion with us today. Thank you so much, Jeffrey.
Well, thank you for inviting me. I'm happy to be here.
Of course, of course. So first, I wanted to ask a few questions briefly about Jainism and the Dharma traditions.
Okay.
For those who may not be familiar with the Dharma traditions, could you begin by offering us a brief overview of some of the traditional Hindu and Jain beliefs and practices?
Certainly. So there's, of course, enormous variety within these traditions. So it's impossible to really summarize all of Hinduism in particular, because it's actually made up of many traditions that have come together gradually through a complex process over the course of many centuries. And the Jain tradition itself also is an extremely ancient tradition, also has a couple of different schools of thought. It's not as widespread a tradition in terms of having many, many sub-traditions. It's a relatively small community, the Jain community, but it's been a tremendously important one in the history of Indian thought and practice and globally as well. But there are some shared ideas that unite Hindus and Jains, and to some extent also Hindus, Jains, Buddhists, and Sikhs, if we look at the entire range of the Dharma traditions. And so one concept, again, with diverse interpretations given in the various traditions, is karma, which this has practically become an English word now. But karma is the principle that for every action, every thought, every word, every deed, right? Whatever we do, whether it's with the body, whether it's with our mind, whether it's with our power of speech, those actions reverberate throughout the cosmos, and they eventually come back to us in the form of an experience. So a simplified way of saying this very often is that whatever good we do, whatever we do that is done out of compassion, out of love, out of a sense of selflessness, that this comes back to us in the form of happiness, in the forms of good experiences. And whatever we do that is harmful, that is violent, that emerges from out of selfishness or greed or ego, produces suffering for others, but of course, ultimately for ourselves as well. And so We are caught in inextricably in a web of causation that binds us with every other being in the universe. Everything that we are doing at all times is affecting other beings, and those effects eventually come back and we experience them. In the Dharma traditions, this is closely tied with the concept of rebirth, which is also a common view that's held across these traditions. The idea that what we are fundamentally is not this physical body that we tend to identify with, but we are spiritual beings who are temporarily inhabiting a physical abode or identifying with the physical body. And the physical body and its experiences, these have all been shaped by karma, by our past choices. And so we're experiencing the effects of those past choices now, and we are creating our future with the choices we're making in the present moment. And so the reason this ties to the concept of rebirth is because several reasons, but one of them is that if you think of karma as something like cosmic justice, for every good action, there's going to be a good reaction, every bad action, there's a bad reaction. And then we make the empirical observation of how things actually are in the world, it doesn't appear to match up, right? There's a lot of injustice and unfairness. We see, as they say, bad things happen to good people. And if I may be so bold, we can see good things happen to bad people too, right? Life doesn't always seem to balance out. Now, we can respond to that either by saying, well, the world's just a random place and there really is no sense to what happens. But then we wouldn't be inhabiting the Dharma traditions, right? Because the Dharma traditions are committed to the concept of Dharma, that is, the concept of an order that underlies everything. If the universe is a morally random, ambiguous place, then from the perspective of these traditions, it's chaos. And a chaotic universe is one that these traditions reject. The idea is that if things were total chaos, we couldn't have knowledge, we couldn't have life, we couldn't exist as we do. There is an orderliness to things, it's just not always evident to us. And so if the world appears unfair, the Dharma tradition's response to that is, well, we're just seeing a snapshot of our current reality. Maybe we think someone is suffering a lot who doesn't deserve it, or we think that someone is doing a lot of harm and getting away with it. What about what happens next, right? We don't know where they are going. We don't know where they're coming from. According to the Dharma traditions, there's a much longer continuum, a much longer story over many lifetimes, which would then sort of make sense of these experiences that we perceive, and that we that make up our reality. And so you have karma, you have rebirth, and then you have the aspiration to get free from the cycle of rebirth, because eventually the idea is that the soul grows weary of just sort of experiencing, engaging in action and experiencing results, engaging in action and experiencing results. There must be something more, right? There must be some kind of transcendence that makes this whole process meaningful. And so that's affirmed in the idea of moksha or liberation, which is another concept that these traditions share in common. So you have karma, you have rebirth, you have liberation. And then finally, in terms of that's all very metaphysical, in terms of practice, you have moral systems, ethical systems, modes of living, and also spiritual practices, things like ritual, things like meditation, which are aids to reaching that transcendence. So that's in a nutshell what unites the Dharma tradition. So there's the cosmology of karma and rebirth, the goal of liberation, and the ways of life that are conducive to that liberation.
Thank you so much for that answer. I feel like it really succinctly described exactly how they're similar. Could you go a little bit into how Jainism specifically is a bit unique compared to the other Dharma traditions?
Yes. Each of these traditions is unique. Each has its own take on the broad picture I just described. So, for the Jain tradition, karma is not simply a law of nature, as we tend to describe it. It's almost like gravity, or Newton's laws of motion, where every action produces a like reaction. There is also a mechanics of karma. In Jainism, you get an explanation of why there's karma and how karma works. According to the Jain tradition, karma is a material substance, or another way to phrase it is you could say it's an energy that is actually out there in the universe, right? This is not conceptual. This isn't an interpretation of our experience. It's stuff, that's out there. And things that we do, and more specifically, the way the attachments we have that motivate us to act in the way that we do, attracts this material into the soul. And the soul also has a material dimension. It's not matter, the soul. It's consciousness, as you see in other traditions, but it has a location in time and space. And this karmic matter can get connected to it and can flow into it and get stuck to it. And this is what creates the experiences that we have as a consequence of our actions. It's because of this material. And so karma is always flowing into the soul, the jiva, the living being, and flowing out also as we have experiences, right? It comes and it goes. And this means, therefore, that if we want to become liberated, we have to do two things. We have to stop that process of karma flowing in, because it's karma that keeps us tied to the cycle of rebirth. And we have to get rid of the karma that we've already gotten attached to ourselves. It's going to go eventually through the normal, natural process of experiences. But according to the Jains, if you practice what's called tapasya, ascetic practice, things like fasting, for example, you can actually accelerate that process. And in a sense, you could say burn off the karma that is accumulated. I had a student in my Indian philosophy class just the other day who sort of joked that it sounds like burning off calories. And it almost is analogous to that, right? You have this, something that's going to become attached to you that you want to get rid of. And so there is ascetic practice for getting rid of karma. And there's something called samayika, equanimity, which prevents the further influx of karma. That is, you want to cultivate a state of mind that is very calm, that is pure, that is reflective of the original state of the soul, free
Right.
from karma. And there's an actual Jain practice called samayika. It's a meditative practice that's done for a period of about 48 minutes in a day. And one in this process becomes very calm. So through this process of meditation, one is entering a state where no karma is entering into the soul. So you want to so cultivate that it becomes your second nature, so that you're in that
Right.
state of calm all of the time, ideally, and no longer accumulating the karma. So then you get free. And then finally, and I think this is going to be an important point in our further discussions,
Sure.
a key to reaching that state of calm is practicing ahimsa, that is nonviolence in thought, word, and action. And we typically translate it as nonviolence, but I think that doesn't even quite do justice to ahimsa, because when people think of nonviolence, they think of basically non-harming in a kind of physical sense. But ahimsa is the absence of even the desire to do harm to any living being. Many Jains, in fact, Jains that I know will phrase this in positive terms. They say it's love for all beings. It's wishing no harm to any living being. So this is intrinsic to the Jain path. So these are really the strong emphases given in Jainism, that we have to actually
Yeah.
get rid of the karma, and we do that through nonviolence.
Awesome. I wanted to get to know you as a person, as a scholar, just a little bit better. And so, what was it exactly about Hinduism, about Jainism, that drew your interest initially?
Okay, so this a long story. I'll give the short version because I know
Okay,
our time is
okay.
limited. But
Sure.
when I was 10 years old, my father was in an accident, and eventually he lost his ability to move, and eventually lost his life. When I was 12, he passed away. It was all connected with this accident that he had when I was 10. I didn't grow up in a Hindu or Jain tradition or community. I grew up Roman Catholic in a small town in Missouri, about as
Okay.
removed from India as you can probably imagine. I was always very independent-minded, and I always sort of had my own theories and interpretations of the way things worked. But I was also quite a devout Catholic. I was planning to be a priest when I grew up, and I was an altar boy, and I was very involved in the church. But I didn't think that truth was only to be found in the church, right? I understood there were other religions out there. And after my father passed away, I really sort of embarked on a very serious search for answers to questions about things like, why do we suffer? Why did what happened to my father happen to my father? What
Right.
happens after we die? What is the point of all of this, right? All the big questions.
Sure.
And The answers I found most compelling were those I found in the traditions of India. And there was a particular incident where I came across a copy of the Bhagavad Gita in a at a sale at a church parking lot, and it just I opened the book and it instantly spoke to me, and the account it gave of the immortality of the true self and how it passes from one body to the next. This fit very well with the way of thinking that I was already kind of developing. And so one thing led to another. Right? I gradually, I began to immerse myself in reading anything I could find about Hinduism, about Buddhism, about Vedanta philosophy, all of it, and other traditions as well. But I kept going back to the Indian traditions. I actually eventually met an Indian family. This sounds like a stereotype, but a Gujarati family who ran the local motel. And there are a lot of Gujarati in America who run motels. So one of the children needed a math tutor. And so by the time I was in high school, I was asked to be the math tutor. So I got to know the whole family very well. And they had their puja, they had their worship every Monday night. So I used to go every Monday and they would have Indian food and they would let me sit and watch and after a while participate in what they were doing. Then I went to a Catholic university, went to University of Notre Dame, as you mentioned in my introduction. And like you said there, that was where I really could tell because they had really wonderful professors there who were very well versed in Catholic theology and the church. And I really understood that the interpretation I had developed of things was just, it was different enough from what the church teaches that like the whole idea of being a priest and being a Catholic theologian, it was going to be a very difficult road for me. I would either be in trouble all the time because my views were so strange and different, or I wouldn't be able to express my views. And I think I'm physically incapable of that. So, I found myself drawn to a practice of Hinduism. And eventually ended up in the Vedanta tradition of Sri Ramakrishna, which is the tradition that I inhabit. In terms of the Jain tradition, I was really drawn to the study of Jainism when I was working on my doctoral dissertation, because another aspect of all the Indian traditions that interests me is the teaching that whatever path we're following can eventually lead us to that ultimate goal of liberation, right? That it's not an exclusivist worldview. It's very open and inclusive, and but this idea of pluralism and openness was something that had come under attack quite a bit by Western philosophers of religion and theologians. And in my dissertation, I wanted to defend it, and I
Sure.
also wanted to write on Indian philosophy. And I found of all the schools of Indian philosophy, the one that really went the most deeply with this idea was the Jain tradition, where a concept called Anekantavada is developed, the multiplicity of reality and the fact that the seemingly contradictory claims made in various traditions can actually be resolved if we see them as referring to different aspects and dimensions of reality. So theism and atheism, does God exist or not? Well, it depends on what you mean by God. All the various issues, right? You can see the different sides of them. And in fact, people always say there are two sides to every issue. According to Jain philosophy, there are seven sides to every issue. It's much more complex even than two
Right.
sides. So, with that form of logic, I thought it would be possible to reformulate pluralism in a way that would address some of the criticisms that it had received. So, that was my dissertation topic. That informed my first book. And after writing my first book and seeing the influence of Jain thought in my Hindu theology, my publisher said, "Why don't you write an introduction to Jainism?" So I did a lot of research. I wrote my book, Jainism, An Introduction. I'd like the chance at some point to do a second edition of that because I think I've learned more about the Jain tradition since writing that book than I knew when I wrote it. So I'd like to go back and
Right.
expand on it. But the Jain community has been very warm and very receptive to my work. And I find Jain values also deeply inform my own life and my own understanding. I have a joke that some of my friends in the Vedanta tradition say that my Vedanta sounds very Jain, and some of my Jain friends say my Jainism sounds very Vedantic. And I think I'm on the boundary of those two traditions, I think, in some sense.
Right. Oh. Well, thank you for that answer. It's awesome to get to know scholars in a more personal level. So that's awesome. And we wanted to ask just one more question in terms of your personal life. As a professor, do you incorporate environmental ethics within your teaching framework of the Dharma traditions?
I do, because I think one of the important things about I'm teaching in the context of the United States to college students who mostly have little or no understanding before studying it of any of the Indian traditions. Maybe they had a Hindu or Jain friend in school, but I get very few Hindu or Jain students. I get a few. The ones who come to our college tend to take class with me, but we have a very low population of students whose background is from these traditions. So most of the students don't know anything about it, but they're very curious. They want to know. And I think an important thing in explaining these traditions to students is showing the relevance of these traditions to contemporary issues, right? That I find very often our students are just starving for different perspectives. And in America today, we tend to hear two points of view being bounced back and forth and with increasing aggression and polarization. And there are outlooks on topics which are, like hot button topics in America, like abortion, for example, and of course, ecology and the ecological crisis. There are perspectives from Hindu, Jain, Buddhist, Sikh traditions that just aren't part of that back and forth dynamic that most of the students are familiar with. They're like, wow, there's another whole way of thinking that I never even knew about. And that makes so much sense. A lot of them come to the conclusion, right? They see the logic of the traditions. And of course, in my field, there's a big emphasis on being critical. And I certainly don't want to romanticize these traditions. And I say, yeah, India has problems, and the practitioners of these traditions are human beings and make mistakes, which, by the way, that's what the traditions teach. We're all suffering from ignorance, right? We're all suffering from avidya. We all have our karmas. So we should expect that, right? But I really want to pass on these ideals because, and I think this probably anticipates some of what we're going to discuss. I think that ideals from the Dharma traditions are vital to the survival of humanity, really. That we're either going to, well, I sometimes joke, we're either going to have the Star Trek future or the Mad Max future. And I fear sometimes we're careening toward the Mad Max future. But I'm hoping for the Star Trek future, right? Where we sort of look back with much deeper wisdom on the world today and say, oh, weren't we barbaric back in the 21st century, right? We're so much wiser now. And I think the Dharmic wisdom is a big part of that. That understanding that can really help us to get beyond the very negative habits, what in these traditions are called the very negative sanskaras that we collectively have right now as a human species.
Amazing. Well, now I'm going to give it off to Philip Clayton, the president of EcoSiv, so that you guys can bounce some of these ideas off of each other.
Fantastic. Thank you.
Jeffrey, I've been looking forward to this conversation for a long time. I have 16 themes and 16 minutes.
Okay.
And what I'd love to do is to sort of put a bunch of rich questions, each one of which is you could talk about for an hour, and let the audience see sort of how you start into the discussion. Or if you're just telling us the landscape of how you would approach this question,
Okay.
I think that could be really rich. It's like advertising an entire semester course in 15 minutes. And yeah, let's
This
just kind
tight
of
version.
explore the waterfront,
Right. Very
and then that hopefully will give the grounds for future conversations.
excellent.
We'll invite you back.
Okay.
Let's start with the theme of this project that Uberoi has so generously funded and that EcoSiv is working on around the country for a year or longer. And that's the theme of it was Jainism and the ecological mindset, or ecological mindset in the Dharma traditions. How would you even parse such a term in the language of the Dharma traditions? Is it incommensurable, or is there some kind of parallel or analogy that you could find in any Dharma tradition?
Right. I don't think it's incommensurable, but it is certainly different from how the Dharma traditions express themselves. I would say that For the Jain tradition, Jains would not see their tradition as being primarily about the environment. What we can observe, though, is that the Jain commitment to certain values like nonviolence, like aparigraha, detachment from material things, anekantavada, which I mentioned, the diversity of views, that the outcome, a kind of side effect, if you will, of living like a Jain is producing a society that is far more ecologically responsible than the one that we have based on materialism and its values. So that's how I would say that.
Yeah. So could it be that by focusing in on ecology or the environmental crisis, the West loses the tools it most needs to address that crisis?
I think so. I think so because we all too often leave behind the bigger metaphysical cosmological questions. We sort of take a certain type of Newtonian materialism for granted, and that is the very thing that's at the basis of the crisis. I think if we trace its historical roots.
That makes me think that there must be other sort of fundamental differences of paradigm in the West that are causing us to stumble in a way that, in particular, the Jain tradition wouldn't. How about this one? None of the Dharma traditions is dualistic. How important for the global environmental crisis is overcoming dualistic thinking, or the West might say, a dualistic mindset?
Right. Now, of course, there are aspects of the Dharma traditions which can sound dualistic, like the distinction between the jiva and the physical body, for example. But if you look at the broader philosophy and the context, it's not really a dualism in the sense of like a Cartesian dualism, where one of these things is greatly valued and the other is not, right? The material world is the field in which the soul has its experiences and is essential to the liberation process. So when we see that all of these things are part of a process, that the cosmos acts like an organism, and we see this, and again, one of the Hindu traditions that you're familiar with, Vishishtadvaita, the idea that this whole cosmos is the body of the divine reality, is ultimately it's a non-dualism, and I like this term Vishishtadvaita. It's non-dualism, but with difference, right? It's not a non-duality that obliterates difference. The
Yeah.
difference is there. But it fits together. And in the Jain tradition, too, you could see thinkers like Kunda Kunda, for example, in the Digambara tradition, has a very non-dualistic way of talking about the soul. And so I think that our dualism, our tendency in the West, I think, to see ourselves as somehow abstracted or separate from the rest of reality is our problem, right?
Yeah.
We see ourselves in it.
So we have to give you that sentence just a little bit of attention. So a materialistic view of the soul, some people say that that would be ultimately what metaphysics would say about the view of the soul in Jain traditions, Digambara. Is that overstating it? And is there any way in the West you could even speak of a soul in materialistic terms? Or is that just so foreign to our mindset?
I think it's been foreign to the mindset since Descartes. I think if you dig deeper in the Western traditions, you'll also find affinities with non-duality. Of course, one famous example, people talk about Meister Eckhart, for example, great example of a non-dualistic Christian thinker. And if you dig even deeper back into the early church fathers, and then of course you get into those Christianities that didn't survive, but whose works we now have, the Gnostics, which very fortuitously their texts were discovered back in the 20th century, and we see that there's non-duality there as well. Like the when Jesus talks, when he uses this I am phrase, and it's interpreted often in the tradition as, ah, he is that. You worship him, follow him. But maybe he's expressing something which can we can all real that we can all say that I am.
Tatvamasi.
Tattvamasi, he's inviting us to Tattvamasi. You are that. I am Brahman. That infinite spirit is within all of us. And a being like Jesus is someone, has fully realized that, but then his existence is an invitation to us to realize it too. But instead, we kind of objectify it and turn it into an
Beautiful. That is a
worship.
great answer, Jeff. Stepping your mind and your soul back into the heart of the Dharma. And looking at contemporary Western society, how would you help Westerners, how would one who's in that place help Westerners understand the ways in which we're dualistic? Is it true? I mean, is one of the first things that a person from a Dharma perspective would say is that dualism that has so deeply divided much Western thinking and action, is that just a stereotype or is that for real?
I think there's deep truth in it. I would say dualism and to a great extent the materialism, by which I mean the reductive materialism,
Oh,
right?
that's really interesting.
That we are only this body, right? Now the idea that the body is an important thing that we need to honor. It's part of the whole organism of what we are. That has to be affirmed. But I find that because of I think because there's a kind of, I think among a lot of the younger people, an intuitive reaction against the old dualism. But instead of going to a non-duality that really pulls all of these elements together, they pick one side or the other. So they go with materialism, or they go with a kind of fundamentalism, right?
Interesting. So even confronted with the option to move to a different way of seeing, we dualize that once
Right,
again.
exactly. And what we need to work on is integrating. And the thinker I really love in this regard from India is Sri Aurobindo, right? And he talked about the integral yoga and how the material and the spiritual are different dimensions of one reality, that there is evolution and involution, right? Depending on how we look at that dynamic. And so I think integration is the key to overcoming dualism. That dualism keeps things apart. Integration makes non-duality then possible. I think very
Nice.
often we end up with a false non-duality that is just picking one side or the other and
It's
rejecting
right.
the
It's
other.
a dualistic non-duality,
That's a nice way of putting it.
which is not Vaisheshta, right? So,
Which not is.
Can I jump in for just one second? So,
Go.
as somebody who is of the younger generation, I think it's interesting what you're saying about materialism because there is this trend towards minimalism within the youth. And it's almost a fad. It's almost one of those things where either you're minimalistic or you're materialistic, and there's absolutely no in between. So it's interesting what you're talking about, trying to integrate that. And I wonder in what ways my generation per se would be able to do that in a way where I feel like if I'm materialistic, minimalists are judging me. But if I'm minimalist, materialists are like, how is that even possible? So anyway,
Oh,
just wanted to bring that up. Yeah.
yeah, that's a great example of how we do, you sort of separate ourselves into camps. And yes, and I'm glad you're here because it's so very easy for us older people to talk about the younger generation and what they should do and what they should think. But I'm very hopeful about the younger generation because there's such an openness and a desire for something. I sense a deep awareness that there's something wrong with the way we're headed collectively right now. And as they say in the field of addiction, the first step to recovery is admitting you have a problem. And I feel like what I hear from a lot of the people in your generation, Juliana, is you're sort of crying out to all of us, we have a problem, right? And so and one of the things I love about the Dharma traditions is I think they provide perspectives and answers that are otherwise either unavailable in the Western tradition, or they require a thorough encyclopedic knowledge of the Western tradition to be located because they've been kind of buried and sort of pushed out of the mainstream. So like I mentioned the Gnostics as an example of that. The Platonists and Neoplatonists another great example of that. The whole mystical stream of in the Catholic Church, and then you've got the Quaker tradition. These are all there in the West. And I think they have a lot of the same insights that we find in the Dharma traditions, but they've been marginalized by the mainstream discourse.
Or somehow they've drunk the water of Western assumptions and dualisms. Let's just jump directly to Jainism. Jainism has been called the ecological religion or worldview par excellence.
Yes.
And when if, I mean, you think of the commitments that monks and nuns make to do no harm, to take the lease from the earth, individuals. Is that just a trope, or is there some deep realization as you, as a comparative scholar of religion, think your mind across the traditions?
Oh, I think that's absolutely true. And in fact, I cannot think of another tradition that is more or even as committed to an ideal of nonviolence and an ideal of, I don't like the word detachment. I sometimes like the Sanskrit words better, aparigraha, non-grasping.
Yes.
Not going through the world thinking, oh, I want that, I want that, I want that. But maybe just going through the world and observing how beautiful it all is and appreciating it and not disturbing it, right? And, you know, the idea of doing no harm, ahimsa, I mean, it's such a noble ideal. And of course, right away, we get objections that, well, that's impossible in practice. But again, I think it's coming from this Western mindset that we're talking about a set of rules. And if you're not able to follow the rules, then you're somehow in transgression. I think we're talking about an ideal to which we aspire. And an aspirational ideal can motivate you to go much further than you would otherwise have gone. Whereas if we make it a rule and they say, well, we can't fulfill the rule, therefore we have failed. You know, it's like New Year's resolutions that are, you know, by late February, by now, you know, they're all gone.
I'm so glad you brought that up, because I think it's crucial to this discussion. You spoke of it as an ideal we aspire to.
Mm-hmm.
Western approaches to living differently seem so often to be led by guilt.
Yes.
So you're wrong, you know, it's wrong to eat meat. You should just feel guilty about that. That should motivate change. I love how some of my Jain friends will say to somebody who eats meat 7 days a week, well, have you thought about trying not to eat meat just on Tuesday evening at dinner?
Right.
And then
right.
they come back 2 weeks later and the guy says, yeah, I feel great. But have you thought about adding Thursday?
Right.
It's motivated
right.
as a kind of experiment in living. Experiments of truth. We think of Gandhi's own autobiography. Right. Is there something essential, something deep about this approach to reducing consumption in a guilt-free environment? Or is that an idealization and romanticization of Jain practice?
Well, it might be romanticization in the case of, I mean, there may be individual Jains who treat it that way, you know, as a set of rules that they maybe are abiding by or not. But what I find in terms of the deeper wisdom of the tradition is that what you're saying is very accurate.
Mm-hmm.
Right? That, this moderation of our desires. And I think it's extremely pragmatic. I think it also shows that while this tradition may sound very idealistic, it's very psychologically insightful. And
yes.
I think the Jains have long understood that if I try to go from being, say, an average American consumer to a Jain monk overnight, it's not going to work. And in fact, within days, I'm not only will I be back to my consumerist way of life, but I'll be back to it with a vengeance, because I'll have missed whatever I was doing. But this sort of gradually ramping down, you know, that's anyone who has tried to follow a dietary regime or an exercise regime or an educational process, okay, I'm going to read all these books in 2 days. No, but just, you know, read a little bit every day and then, you know, add to it. And that works. And then what you eventually find is you, and I found this with my own meditation practice, you want to do more, right? You reach the point, okay, well, I'll do this for 20 minutes a day. Okay, well, I'd like to try 30 because I really like what this is doing for my mind and my awareness. And
take a related theme, since you have some awareness of Catholic practice and tradition,
yes.
Is there a parallel, you know, the monks and nuns are people who represent a kind of holiness that the merchant can't achieve traditionally.
Right.
And for an average Jain, a secular Jain, to see monks and nuns, it represents a kind of spiritual ideal. As you say, they ramp down to the point to this thing of salekana, where they simply stop consuming at all and pass peacefully into, you know, the next life.
Yes.
I wonder how you, if there's a parallel there, and could that be helpful? They're kind of like ecological saints without mm-hmm. guilt.
I think
where does that take you?
Yeah, I think that's a wonderful way to think of it. A term I used in my book Jainism Introduction from the Christian tradition was prophetic witness. Right? That the prophets, if you go back to the Hebrew Bible, were people who did very radical things that the average person was not expected to do, but by doing so, they served as a sign, right? They pointed the way to everyone. Like, this is the ideal toward which you should be moving. And I see that as well. Yeah, and as you say, Catholic priests and monks and nuns can serve that role of moral exemplars. And you're like, I want to be more like that person, you know. Mm-hmm. And then, and it's the same way, I think, within the Jain tradition, that the Jain monks and nuns, the sadhus and sadhvis, are the ideal, and
That's
they're embodying
beautiful.
that ideal. And even if not everyone can do it, they can move toward that. And even just a little motion in that direction would so drastically reduce our consumption as to have a big impact.
So helpful, Jeff. So I want to let Juliana to close the show and bring in some last questions. So let me pack three heavy questions into my last two and a half, our last 2.5 minutes. Ethics in the United States in particular seems so separate from sort of deeper spiritual realities. It's a specialization now in colleges. We teach computer ethics and business ethics and medical ethics. That's just doesn't seem to be true in Jainism or the other traditions. Can you just give us a sense of what does ethics mean or ethical aspiration in Dharma traditions? It's
in
so different.
Yeah, in the Dharma tradition, the ethics are part of a holistic worldview. So everything implies everything else. And I think the way we have tried to approach the diverse worldviews we have in America, I think it's been well-intentioned, but I think there's a flaw in it, which is secularism as we know it basically sets aside that larger set of holistic visions. I would like to see an educational system in the U.S. where students learn about all the major traditions in school, and not just in high school, but from an early age, learning a little bit about all of them, not as indoctrination. Again, the people will have their own traditions, but they will then have a better ability to intuitively perceive the connection between ethics and a larger way of life. And they'll start to see that for all of their differences, there's an awful lot uniting all of these traditions that we call religions, that there's more common than there is separate.
That's a beautiful vision. One last question on Jainism. When you spoke earlier of the Jain notion, the Sanskrit word anekantavada, you said the multiplicity of reality, which reminds me of ecosystems theory. Ecosystems theory sees everything as interrelated and interdependent. It's a science of connection. Is there really an analogy there?
I think there is. In my dissertation, I argued, and in some later work, I've argued that if you bring in Alfred North Whitehead's term prehensions, it helps understand the concept of anekantavada, because what an entity is a, as Whitehead would say, a nexus of prehensions. Now, that sounds like Sanskrit probably to most people. What it means is that a thing is what it is, but it is also, in a sense, what it is not. Right. Yeah. So part of what a rock is that it is not a pen. Right. So this is a very abstract sense in which every item in the world is connected with every other one. Yeah. In its very being, right? It's what the Buddhists call shunyata, right? It's the interdependence of everything.
And the very last question. In the West, the Western Abrahamic traditions place a great stress on love. Rabbis have said that the love commandments in Torah are the heart of the law, the essence of the law. Jesus chose those two commandments as central in his teaching. The focus on the divine compassion is basic for Islam. You've spoken of the centrality of ahimsa as love for all beings. Is it the same concept, or is there some difference that we should keep in mind?
I think there's a difference, and it leads to a beautiful complementarity where you could see the Abrahamic insight and the Dharmic insight really kind of forming an integral whole. Because if we say, if we come from a Christian perspective, say we should love everyone, right? Everyone is made in the image of God. Okay, well, that means there are things that we should do for people, right? There are things we owe people, right? This is where the concept of justice comes in. But it's also important to know what we should not do to our fellow beings. And that's where I think ahimsa comes in. Do no harm. And my critique of much of Western history is that horrific things have been done out of what were initially good intentions, right? Love unchecked by this sense of well, what does my neighbor not want done? can lead us to interfere in civilizations, in ecosystems, in one another's lives, in ways that are very destructive and very, very harmful. So I think love and ahimsa sort of form a circle. Where in love, you know, we all need to be there for one another. We need to hold each other in our hearts with care. But part of that is knowing when to leave people alone.
Yeah, that's beautiful.
Alone and ecosystems alone. Yeah.
I'd like to invite Juliana back in for the closing of the show. As she's stepping back in, can I just say, it sounds like what we call the positive and negative formulations of the Golden Rule. Maybe the most general ethical principle, do unto others, is the positive formulation. And the prophet said in the spoken word, don't do to others what you don't want. Is that the distinction you were just introducing?
I think so. I think so. Yes. That ahimsa is don't do to other beings what would be harmful to you.
Or thank you so much.
What would be harmful to you if you were them, right?
Yeah. Thanks so much, Steph.
Thank you.
Let me unmute myself. If I just wanted to end off the podcast with one final question. If Jain principles were implemented in a society today, how would it look different than many of the societies around us? And what are two principles of Jainism that you think should be implemented into society today?
So I think if these principles were implemented with seriousness, right, it would happen from a very early age. It would have to be like, we would have to be educated into this. And the principles... you've said two. It's hard for me to pick two. I tend to think in terms of three. The three A's, right? Ahimsa, aparigraha, anekantavada. That to do no harm, to not grasp after things, to let things be, to let people be, to let ecosystems be, and to be open to all perspectives and perceiving things as the other being also perceives it. I think these would transform our society radically, because right now a lot of what we do is based on fear. We think that other people are going to try to take advantage of us, or they're going to exploit us, they're going to harm us, and often maybe they will, but it's because they're enthralled by the same sort of mindset that they have to grasp and they have to strike first in order to be happy and to thrive, but they're creating more harm for themselves and more harm for everyone else. So maybe we could even articulate it the way Philip suggested, to do to others what we would want done to us, and to not do to others what we would not want done to us. Yeah.
That makes Which sense. Yeah.
Very dramatically. We'd be one big happy family if we all followed that.
Definitely. Yeah, I think as the future generation speaking, I really hope that that does happen one day, because as I've gotten to learn more about Jainism, it's really provided me a lot of inspiration on how I hope the future to look. So,
excellent. Me too. Same here.
Yeah. Thank you so much. It's been our privilege, Jeffrey, to have you on our podcast today. And yeah, it's just been such a rich discussion. And I feel like not only have I learned a lot, but like I said, I've just felt really inspired by what you have to say. If you want to learn more about Jainism and the environment, make sure to tune in to more upcoming episodes of our podcast series. And just thank you again so much for your time, Jeffrey. I know it's a bit late, but it's really sweet of you to take the time and chat with us for an hour. It's really been a privilege. So,
well, privilege is mine. Thank you for having me here.
Of course. We encourage you to join us for more via social media, whether that be on our Instagram, Facebook, on X, LinkedIn, or our website, ecosiv.org. And whether you're listening to this in the morning, in the evening, at night, we hope you have a beautiful rest of your day, and make sure to tune in for more. Thank you so much.